Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 62 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe, that's Crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. We currently have close to 500 likes on Facebook, and now over 100 followers on Twitter. You can help boost both those numbers by telling your friends about this show. Also, another advantage of following the show is that I post interesting articles throughout the week, as well as notices of the new weekly shows in both places. It's interesting that the most downloaded show is number 46 on nuclear issues with Helen Caldicott. But Jim West's show on ultrasound, number 62, is quickly coming up behind. Other really popular shows were number 1, my introductory show, number 3 with Peter Gottschy on mammography and corruption in the pharmaceutical industry, number 27 on the CDC vaccination scandal with Tony Bark, MD, number 34, my Ebola update. Do you remember the so-called Ebola epidemic? And finally, number 54 on the Trace Amounts movie, which was about mercury and vaccines. Today's guest is Brian Martin, a professor of social sciences at the University of Wollongong, Australia. He's the author of 13 books and hundreds of articles on nonviolence, whistleblowing, scientific controversies, information issues, democracy, and other topics. He's vice president of Whistleblowers Australia and runs a large website on the suppression of dissent, bmartin.cc, and I'll include that in the show notes. His PhD was in theoretical physics from Sydney University, but he's taught a wide range of subjects, including communication studies, environmental issues, peace studies, and the politics of technology. He's undertaken many community research projects with the group Schweik Action Wollongong. This group is named after the First World War novel Good Soldier Schweik by Hasek. This imaginary soldier caused havoc in the Austrian army by pretending to be extremely stupid. Whistleblowing and scientific dissent are sometimes like two sides of the same coin. Whistleblowers tend to come out of organizations that are doing something physical, like the military or industry. The actions of these organizations can easily result in death or injury, and this is usually denied by the hierarchy. And most people who are inside the organizations go along with it, even when they know a lot of what is being said to the public is a lie. Whistleblowers try to find a way to let the public know what's really going on. Scientists are more thinkers than doers. Sure, they may make experiments, but those are generally on a small scale and are designed to have minimal impact on people during the experiment, although the consequences when their ideas are put into action by governments, industry, and the military can be very significant. Scientists can provide a series of profitable ideas, such as research supporting certain drugs, for example, and therefore there is immense pressure on them derived from the eventual profits that can be made from their ideas or that can be lost if a scientist is to say something negative about current products or activities. Since science has become a highly hierarchical organization, there is a tendency to go with the flow, just as if it was a military organization, not rock the boat, because if you do rock the boat, your ability to publish, to get grants, to speak at conferences, to get graduate students, to get promotions, this can all be easily disrupted. But there are some scientists who don't see the danger signals or deliberately ignore them and speak their truth regardless. So now let's go to our guest, Brian Martin. Welcome to the show, Dr. Martin.
You can call me Brian.
Okay, I'll call you Brian from now on. Brian, three of the topics that you study are nonviolence, whistleblowing, and scientific dissent. What are the connections between these three topics, in your opinion? I wouldn't have necessarily thought of them as connected before I saw them on your website.
Well, they aren't necessarily connected. In fact, I started studying them separately, but there are connections. And so nonviolent action is strikes, boycotts, sit-ins and various methods of protest, which often used to challenge repressive governments. But then whistleblowers are often going to speak out about some of the similar problems. So there is a connection between nonviolent action and whistleblowing. Whistleblowing isn't nonviolent action on its own, but it can be part of an overall challenge to authority. And then there's scientific controversies, and what I came up with there is that in many of these, let's say nuclear power or pesticides or fluoridation, when there are dissident scientists, namely scientists who are challenging the orthodoxy, they often suffer in various ways, various types of reprisals. They might not be able to get jobs. They might lose their research grants. They might be censored. And so that's related to whistleblowing, because in whistleblowers, people are trying to speak out in the public interest, and so whistleblowing has a natural affinity to dissent, which you see as an important factor in scientific controversies.
Listeners to this show are probably familiar with the idea that science often acts more cohesively, with more unanimity than the data supports. It tends to latch onto a particular theory and doesn't want to let it go. And sometimes these theories are connected with industry. One of the examples you use is Tyrone Hayes, who studied atrazine. I don't know if it was Monsanto that produces atrazine, but I recently read that the company had a special department to go after people who are criticizing its products. Have you heard about this, and what do you think about that?
Doesn't surprise me at all. There's a lot of this goes on. And, I mean, the classic example is smoking. The tobacco industry, when it was more dominant and still trying to resist the idea that smoking caused cancer, would go after various people who were doing research showing that link.
Yes. Can you give more details about the case of Tyrone Hayes? Because that's a really interesting one, and it's still ongoing. It's still relevant.
That's right. Well, it's part of the wider debate about pesticides, and atrazine is a pesticide that some people say it has quite serious effects, and Tyrone Hayes has been doing research on that, and if you go online, you'll find all sorts of fascinating features about the particular debate and his role in it. And he's an unusual character, but then he's also come under attack. One thing I can say, having talked to dozens or probably hundreds of dissidents over several decades, is that some of them, you might say, well, this is an unusual person. Maybe they're coming under attack because they've got a weird personality. But on the other hand, you've got a lot of ones who are just plain straight up and down scientists who happen to have a different belief than the orthodoxy, and they can come under attack just as well.
Yeah, I think that's also true in the case of military whistleblowers. One thing I've noticed about all the U.S. whistleblowers and leakers, most of them started as patriotic Americans who wanted to join the military or whatever and defend their country. But when they got into it, they realized that there were some pretty bad things going on. But it probably took them quite a long time to get to the point where they could, release sensitive information, because they thought there were crimes happening within their bureaucracy and there was no other way to solve the problem. There was nobody to go to actually resolve it.
Yes, well, it's certainly talking to whistleblowers, it's a very common pattern that they are not necessarily politically conservative, but they believe in the system. In other words, they're conscientious workers. They're working in some job. It could be in the military. It could be teachers, public servants in corporations. It could be working in trade unions. There's a whole range of occupations, but the dynamics are very similar. Is they believe the system works. They find out there's something questionable that's going on. They might have direct evidence or might just have suspicions. And because they believe the system works, then they speak out. They report it to their boss, or they report it to the board of management, or they go to some watchdog body
Right, following the right channels.
That's right. They follow the channels. And then what happens is because those channels are so seldom effective, especially if you're challenging something that's fairly deep, you know, like high-level corruption, then those channels don't work and the whistleblowers suffer both reprisals and also the failure of their complaints to receive a decent hearing, and they become incredibly disillusioned. It's like challenging their whole worldview, and it's much harder for whistleblowers than it is for activists who, you know the system has problems and they systematically go about trying to change it as a campaign without the same sort of illusions.
Yeah, I can see that a whistleblower is likely to be an idealist, and probably, as you say, they started in the system with an idealistic view about things, but they're also idealistic enough to want to let people know about what's going on. Whereas other people who just say, well, we know there are bad things in the military. We know a few people got tortured. We know a few people got injured or killed by these pesticides. But I've got a family. I got a mortgage to pay, and I need to keep my life going. It's going to destroy my life if I do anything. So I'm just going to shut up.
Yes. Now, you've pointed to the absolutely crucial role of bystanders. So let's say there's, in the military, there's some corruption, you know, there's paybacks for this, or there might be, serving officers who are appointing their mates, or there might be some sort of abuse going on. And there's some people who just don't even see it. In fact, whistleblowers often higher up in the system, they're more likely to see things that those who are down in the rank and file don't even know about. And then there's others who simply believe the authorities. So they think, oh, yes, this is the way we're supposed to do it. And anyone who speaks out, doesn't matter whether they're right or wrong, they shouldn't be speaking out. And so, you know, they're the traitor. And then you get the people who actually have a conscience and who think, oh, I should be speaking out. I should be doing something. But, you know, I've got a family to support. I've got a mortgage. I can't afford to do this. I wish I could. And some of those people can provide behind-the-scenes help. And it's very common for whistleblowers to have workmates come up and say, oh, good on you. I'm glad you're doing this, but they won't do anything themselves.
I can see that. I mean, I can see two reactions. One of them is, if you're not the whistleblower, is to defend yourself from the thought that maybe you're part of a corrupt system. You might attack the whistleblower. You might say, that's not true. You're just making stuff up and things like that. The other thing is to say that it's really good you're doing that, and that sort of solves your conscience. Because if he's doing it and destroying his career, I don't have to do it and destroy my career.
And you've just pointed to one of the crucial features of the attacks on whistleblowers is, in my view, there's two audiences for this. I mean, one's the whistleblower themselves, the various reprisals, whether it's ostracism or reprimands or petty harassment or, you know, on up to dismissal or even assault. Those sort of reprisals can be seen as an attempt to get the whistleblower to shut up or to drive them out or discredit them. But the other audience is other employees, and attacking whistleblowers sends a message to the others saying, don't do this. And in some ways, that's far more important.
I'm trying to think of the name of the MMR vaccine guy.
It's Andrew Wakefield.
Andrew Wakefield, yes, thank you for that. The way I saw it is that there were other people who'd published very similar materials to Andrew Wakefield. I really thought they were trying to make an example of him to other doctors who may have had concerns about vaccines, or researchers who might want to look into the potential that there might be damage from some vaccines. And so they didn't really want to go after 20 or 30 doctors and scientists, so they just picked one. And they'll never stop attacking him. He's radioactive now, or electric, or whatever you want to call it. They'll just never stop going after him. In fact, I don't think that they can ever stop going after a guy like that once they've started.
Yes, well, he's been turned into, the poster boy for what's wrong with critics of vaccination. And the strange thing is Wakefield himself wasn't a strong critic. He did didn't oppose vaccination. He simply said, "Oh, we have concerns about that should be investigated about the triple vaccine or about the measles, and that parents should have the option of having single vaccines." And so, and people don't often realize that he was the first author, but the famous paper that ended up being retracted had over 10 authors. There was a whole bunch of other scientists involved in this research, and it wasn't definitive research saying, vaccination causes autism. It's simply saying there might be a connection, and it ought to be investigated further. So it's a fascinating story, but those sort of details hardly ever get in the mass media treatments.
And do you think that there was something else that made Wakefield such a poster boy or whipping boy? Was he particularly well-spoken or less malleable to coercion or something like that? Hints that he should just shut up? Like, was there something else about Wakefield that made him the target of attack and not other scientists and doctors who were publishing with him and researching with him?
This way, it's complicated and there's probably no definitive answer, but there's several factors. One is media coverage, because the media took up the story. Now, the original media coverage was actually sanctioned by Wakefield's hospital, but then it became a target of concern, because the media coverage then generated a lot of concern by parents, and it seemed to be affecting vaccination rates. But then the major attack on Wakefield waited several years until Brian Deer, journalist, raised all these concerns, and then the General Medical Council in Britain started this massive investigation into Wakefield. And it wasn't to say he's a fraud, the research is wrong. It's about sort of trivial matters concerning declaring a conflict of interest. And Wakefield's chief accuser was guilty of the same thing that he was accusing Wakefield of. So it's all very, very sort of strange to look into it. And I'm not saying Wakefield is necessarily an innocent party, or that that everything he did was right. I think the evidence is very contested, but he's certainly been treated very differently than somebody on the pro-vaccination side who'd do a similar sort of things with conflict of interest and the like.
Yes. I interviewed a British MD a couple of episodes ago named Jane Donegan. She also got in trouble because she testified at a legal hearing over custody of a couple of children. There were two mothers who didn't want to vaccinate their children, but their husbands, who were estranged from their wives, did want to vaccinate. And because she had testified, the General Medical Council went after her. She spent several years fighting to keep her license. Eventually, she prevailed, but it took a huge amount of time and energy and goodness knows how much money over a period of many years before she finally emerged with her license intact.
Yes, well, one of the things I've done on a few debates is to collect evidence about the attacks on dissident scientists, and so vaccination is one of them. I had an article a year or two ago, and Jane Donegan was one of the case studies. And I had Wakefield, but my conclusion was we don't really know whether he was a victim of suppression of dissent, because there's too many complications, because he was treated so differently from others. He was given a much higher level of scrutiny. But then, decades ago, I did a similar thing with critics of nuclear power, and I was able to get evidence that critics in 10 different countries had come under attack. So it's a pattern you see over and over. And also in the fluoridation debate, there's critics of fluoridation in several countries have come under attack. Now, just the ordinary variety campaigners, citizen campaigners, they don't usually come under serious attack, but it's the ones who have credibility, looking at doctors or scientists.
Right.
They're the ones who are more likely to come under heavy attack, because they give credibility to the challenge to orthodoxy.
Right, because the media knows how to deal with someone who is, say, an alternative health practitioner or something like that. When it comes to vaccination, they're pretty easy to dismiss. They're not a proper MD, so what do they know? But when it comes to someone with a proper MD, and that's proper in quotes, or a PhD or something like that, it's more difficult for the media, which is very status-oriented, to say, what's wrong with this person? If they went to medical school like all the mainstream doctors, then why are we supposed to ignore what they say while we believe all the others?
Yes, sir. Now, the role of the media is quite interesting, and it's useful to distinguish two types of journalists. There's the specialist science journalists, and they tend to be more sympathetic to orthodoxy because they need to keep up their connections,
right,
their regular reporting. But then there's the news and current affairs journalists who, for whom controversy is it's a story angle. It makes, you know, this is something interesting, and they're more likely to report on the dissidents. And it's because of this particular feature of the media, and it varies from country to country and issue to issue, but because news and current affairs looks for experts, because they like to quote experts,
right,
but if they find a dissident expert, that's, you know, that can be newsworthy. Well, then that's why those dissident experts so commonly come under attack from orthodoxy, because the media are giving them a bit more attention, and so there's can be great efforts to try and discredit them.
Yes, I don't know if you know, I noticed that you list HIV and AIDS as one of your topics, which is where I started in this whole business of questioning science. Well, maybe it was a bit before that, but it's certainly been a big focus for me. In the United States at the University of Connecticut, there's a psychology professor named Seth Kalkman. I don't know if you've ever heard of him and his research.
No.
So he appears to have been receiving about $1 million a year for research from the National Institutes of Health every year for the past 20 years or so. One of the things he's been researching is the so-called denialists, the people who deny the connection between HIV and AIDS. It seems that every time a paper gets published, like last September, there was a paper published by somebody who'd never published in the area of questioning HIV and AIDS before. It seems that the same day that the paper hit the journal's website, he phoned the author and complained, and I think probably the journal as well. He was complaining about how could such dangerous information see the light of day. He's kind of a clumsy guy, but I think part of his role in his paid research is to go after people who ask awkward questions about things like the connection between HIV and AIDS.
Yes, well, I dislike the word denialist. I mean, it derives from Holocaust denial.
Right.
That's questioning the genocide of the Jews under Nazi Germany, and that's a whole separate debate that you could have. But the issue of denialism in relation to scientific controversies is, I think, much more questionable, because usually there is some debate, and it's not so much even that we're debating the facts, but there's a different framework for looking at these things and a different assumptions about what needs to be proved. And so I've seen this word denialist. It's certainly applied to those who question climate change science. It's applied to vaccination critics and to a number of other things. And I think rather than assuming, you know, we've got the truth on one side, and anyone who doesn't accept this truth is, yeah, you know, we explain their psychology. It's a very one-sided sort of social analysis, because you might say, let's analyze the sociology of those who subscribe to orthodoxy, because 99% of those who subscribe to orthodoxy, probably a higher percentage, have never studied the evidence themselves. They just take it from the authorities in the field, and, you know, I accept the authorities. What does that say? That's some sort of conformity or acceptance of authority, but that's not seen as something to analyze psychologically. We just look at the critics.
Yeah, but I think there is a lot to study there, because hierarchical organizations have a huge impact on people. I think the average person can see this maybe more clearly in a military or intelligence context. Like, take all the torture scandals in the U.S. Military and the CIA, etc. You take people who were probably the kid next door, they joined the military, and the last thing you'd be thinking is that they'd be sticking something up someone's anus in a prison in a faraway land. It's hard to believe that these people started life with such cruelty built into them. I think that people understand that it's the system that warped them, the system that made them like this. I think that what happens in science is not as dramatic, but people do get warped into conformity.
Well, there's some things are just as extreme because you've got if we go back to the Nazis again, the horrific experiments that they carried out.
Yes, that's true.
On various people. And you've got a few things, a few sort of things that go on. Well, let's say if we look at the pharmaceutical companies, and if you look at Peter Gustschy's book, Deadly Medicines and Organized Crime.
I've also interviewed Peter Gustschy in a previous episode.
So you know that you've got people inside the system. They're not actually themselves individually torturing anyone, but they're approving drugs that they know kill people and hiding the fact that they do. So what do you say about that? It's high-level crime.
Yes, you're right. It's very true. Drugs can cause tremendous agony in people who have an adverse reaction. It can affect people for the rest of their life. And the drugs can even cut people's lives short and kill people. I was just reading today, and this is just kind of a random thought because it was just something I happened to see today. Although MRI is a relatively safe procedure, they sometimes give people drugs to make for better imaging. And some of these drugs contain gadolinium, which apparently is quite toxic. And the major companies which produce them, which I think are General Electric and Bayer, are denying that there is any problem with these drugs at all. But there are some people who've had multiple MRIs with the drugs who've experienced really debilitating health effects. Normally, you'd think that something like gadolinium would not be part of a healthy diet.
Certainly not.
I haven't ever seen it on the food chart, along with your vitamins.
Well, what you pointed to there is something that's quite interesting, is that sometimes when there's a new proposal for a new technology, and we bring it in, and if the people who are potentially critical of it can get started early enough, they might be able to stop it. And the classic example here is the supersonic transport. Now, there were a few Concords built, but the plans were to have 500 of these things flying in the U.S., by the 1980s or something like that. And it never happened because the organizers, the critics of the sonic boom and various other complaints got organized and stopped it before it got started. But there's other things that do get established, and if people are raising concerns about it, it's very hard to stop the juggernaut. And the classic case here is the automobile, and Ralph Nader built his career on his classic book, Unsafe at Any Speed.
Right.
But it's hardly stopped the automobile from continuing. It's made them a bit safer. But the whole thing is there. And then the contemporary example is cell phones or smartphones, and the possibility that there are health hazards from electromagnetic radiation from those. And, there's a massive industry supporting this technology, but it's not so much the industry, because we know that the tobacco industry could be challenged, but it's the people themselves are committed to using this technology. And once you start using it, you hardly want to say, this might be giving me brain cancer. I better stop using my phone. Well, it's not many.
Yes, I have a little bit of a conflict of interest there, so I won't comment on that because I don't think I'm unbiased, because I've worked in that industry for a long time. But I agree with you that a lot of people in any industry participate. I think like with MRI and with imaging in general, it's a bit of a slippery slope, because you might start with a relatively low dose of these drugs, and then the doses increase. And in this case, they're giving people drugs to make the picture clearer, so you kind of add one thing at a time. You may have started with something that wasn't that dangerous, but after a long period of time and many technological developments, nobody, patients, doctors, they're all demanding clearer and clearer images. Nobody's seeing the health of the patient as the major goal of the system. It's the quality of the image that becomes more important.
Yes, well, it's can be called the technological imperative. Now, technologies don't actually have any agency of their own, but it's basically the industry, the practitioners, the developers, they they have certain things that they, you know, they say, oh, this is going to be helpful, and then they invest in some massively expensive piece of apparatus to do something.
Right.
They need to find more patients to use it, and it's at all around the place.
Right, and sometimes the technical limitations. Like I just interviewed Jim West, who was studying the health effects of ultrasound. What I was getting from him is that the first ultrasounds were also much less clear than today. But in order to get clearer ultrasound, you have to increase the frequency, increase the power, et cetera, et cetera. And that increases the potential health effects. But if you focus solely on the quality of the image, and if you say to yourself, well, ultrasound has no health effects, so it doesn't matter how high the frequency is, it doesn't matter how high the power is, then you eventually get to the point where you are harming people, and you are in total denial because you have millions and millions invested in the industry, which I guess it's like pesticides, which is another example.
That's right. But interestingly, ultrasound, I think most people would agree it's safer than x-rays. And I mean, the history of x-rays is fascinating because you go back to 1950s and you go into a shoe shop and you stick your foot in a machine and see your bones in your foot. Well, whoops, you're getting a dose of radiation, might give you cancer. Well, but it took a long time before routine chest x-rays were phased out as more causing more harm than good.
Well, they actually used x-rays as therapy for like tuberculosis. And doctors in the 50s had created a disorder of the thymus. And they would diagnose with an x-ray, they would diagnose a child with an enlarged thymus. And then they would use high-dose x-rays to reduce the size of the thymus. And it was probably quite effective at reducing the size of the thymus. But now people say that the size of the thymus doesn't really matter. Your body, you know, figures out what the appropriate size is. And unless there is a cancerous growth or something, there's no issue with that.
I mean, I'm focused on dissent and the problems that dissenters have, but it's often useful to remember that there is progress in a lot of areas and that eventually, you know, the harms that certain things are causing become understood and alternatives are developed. That's not to say it happens everywhere. There's new problems, popping up all the time.
Well, what are some of the successes? It's always good to think about some of the positive things.
Well, I think one of the biggest ones, and this is not normally seen as a medical issue, but it certainly is nuclear weapons. And, they were developed, and, by the time you had the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62, there's this huge quantity of nuclear weapons possessed by Soviet Union and the United States.
Right.
But there was a movement in the late 50s concerned about the, partly driven by the health hazards of fallout from nuclear weapons tests in the atmosphere.
Right, strontium and stuff like that.
Yes, and, in fact, there was, tons of plutonium put up into the atmosphere through the tests. And, people today, we don't know because it's impossible to know, but given that we know that 1/1,000,000th of a gram of plutonium, if it lodges in your lungs, might be enough to cause lung cancer, we might still be, some of us, you never smoke in your life, but you get a little particle of plutonium lodges in your lungs.
Right.
And, so you end up dying as a result of nuclear testing. And so it was the citizen movement in the late 50s and early 60s that led to the end of atmospheric testing. And then it's the movement in the 1980s that led to cutbacks in nuclear arsenals. Now, there's still enough nuclear weapons to kill hundreds of millions or billions of people in the world, and there's a lot of doctors who are campaigning. Doctors against nuclear weapons. And so it's a crucially important health issue in the wider context, but it's certainly true that citizen movements have made the difference and probably have been instrumental in preventing nuclear war occurring.
Yeah, and do you have another example of a positive development?
Well, I'd say this depends on where you live, but the campaign against the tobacco industry has successful in some countries. Now, here I am in Australia. We've got some of the toughest anti-tobacco legislation in the world. I mean, parts of the U.S. are equally good, but I mean, the Australian government has said, you know, you can only sell cigarettes in plain packaging.
Right.
And the tobacco industry said, this is absolutely terrible. We've got to stop this. And they're doing all sorts of tricks to try and use various legislation, you know, global agreements and so forth to stop this sort of packaging. But meanwhile, the tobacco industry is booming in countries like China. And I've seen figures that suggest there might be over the entire century, there might be as many as 1 billion people die as a result of smoking, which, you know, it's up there with, you know, the major sort of global catastrophes, but it's a slow catastrophe. It's a slow process, and therefore doesn't get quite the same attention that something that's going to kill people right now. You know, we got terrorism. Well, terrorism's never killed even 1 million people, much less looking at tens of millions. So,
yeah, we've got a
different sort of standard here about, whoops, we're spending billions of dollars to stop terrorism. Where are the billions of dollars being spent to stop smoking or to stop dangerous pharmaceutical drugs or to, you know, stop some of the other things that we really should be concerned more about?
Well, yeah, in the United States, every year about 30,000 people die in automobile accidents, and about 30,000 die from gunshot wounds. And they get a whole lot less attention than terrorism, even though they are much more serious problems.
And this is an interesting thing about dissent, and it's a concern here, is that sometimes I think the agendas for what's important get set in a certain way, and so there's a lot of attention to certain sorts of debates, and then other sorts of issues get, you might say, they're not swept under the carpet, but they get into the shadows. And if we use vaccination as an example, and I'm neither for or against vaccination, I'm just studying the debate.
Right.
But there's all this attention to vaccination. We must protect kids' lives, and both sides say we're concerned about children's health.
Right.
You know, one side says, well, we need vaccination so that kids won't die of infectious diseases. And the vaccine critics say, well, we don't, you know, we need to have choice so that we don't have kids having side effects from vaccines. That's all fair enough. But then there's other ways to improve children's health. And they're sort of, if they're forgotten. And one of them is to improve living standards of poor people, children in, you know, in homes at risk. And they're the ones most likely to get infectious diseases anyway. But if you're poor, you're not getting proper nutrition. You're potentially subject to abuse from parents or family members. Those are serious matters that are affecting kids. And you know, why aren't they getting the same sort of, you know, massive attention, big debate and so forth that vaccination's getting? Well, it's an interesting question.
Well, I guess exactly the same thing goes for fluoridation, because it's really simple. It's a global intervention. You put the fluoride in the water, it's relatively cheap, and everybody in the city gets it. And then you don't talk about, well, do poor people have access to dental care? Do they have education? Do they understand, you know, what foods are good for their children's teeth and what are not? Like, there's a lot that could be done for dental health outside of fluoridation, but fluoridation becomes a diversion from actually doing something about the dental health of everybody.
Yes, well, I wrote a book about fluoridation controversy. That's some 25 years ago. It's a long time ago. But what's interesting, one of my predictions in the book is certainly coming true, which, as I said, the debate's going to keep going. And it's been going since the 1950s, and it's the more or less the same sort of lineup.
Yes.
And one of the things, I proposed a hypothetical campaign. Instead of, you know, campaigning for fluoridation, dentists and, you know, those supporting, you know, better teeth and so forth could argue for desugarization, which is to say, let's take the added sugar out of processed food and stop, you know, selling all sorts of sweets, lollies,
right,
candies and so forth, and that will improve dental health. But see, if the dentists had done that, they're taking on the food industry.
Right.
And so I considered it the path of least resistance. The dentists will take on the citizen opponents of fluoridation. They're sort of a soft target compared to the food industry. They don't have a lot of money. They've got people power at some level, but they can be more easily discredited as, you know, not experts. But what's the other interesting thing about the fluoridation controversy is that you've got the same sort of pattern where dissenting dentists and doctors and scientists have come under attack, but you've got very different outcomes in different countries. And so I think in the U.S., not many people are aware that fluoridation is only common in a few countries around the world,
yes,
mainly speaking countries, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the U.S. And there's hardly any fluoridation in Europe. And yet they got the same science, and you might say, well, their water supply is different, or, you know, their nutrition's different, or something's different. But basically, no one's going and studying why you've got different outcomes when supposedly the scientific benefits or the health benefits would be the same in different countries.
Yes, well, from what little I know, I think if people looked at fluoridation closely, they wouldn't find any benefits, and they would find some harms. So probably they don't want to look at it too closely. And unfortunately, America in particular has a not invented here syndrome, or perhaps I should say it was invented here, so it must be good syndrome. And I don't know if fluoridation was actually invented in the United States. I think it was, but it's definitely seen as an American intervention. And
yes, it's certainly an innovation. I mean, it was Wisconsin dentists were the ones, I mean, a few of them, originally campaigning in the 1940s to introduce it, and they set up trials with parallel cities, and then they lobbied the United States Public Health Service to endorse fluoridation even before the trials had finished. That was in 1950, and then all the other bodies followed on. So fluoridation is one of the most fascinating stories to my mind, because there is an alternative. There are various alternatives, but for example, you can add fluoride to salt, and so then you could have a choice. And of course, you got fluoride toothpaste. You can buy fluoridated toothpaste or unfluoridated toothpaste, or you don't have to use toothpaste at all, for that matter. And so you've got these various alternatives, but the proponents, oh, we must have it in the water supply, and it's become an article of faith, and, you know, attempts to discredit any of the scientific critics as as some sort of, you know, eccentric people who are, you know, don't know what they're talking about. So it's.
And what are some of the techniques? You mentioned some of the techniques that are used to silence people. One you mentioned is the slap lawsuit, and another is the psychiatric diagnosis, and another I think you also mentioned is anti-terrorism laws. So what are some of the mechanisms to get people to shut up if they just don't want to stop?
Well, we've already talked about the fact that reprisals against whistleblowers send a message to everyone else. So that's one of the key methods. And then you've got, I'd say, there's the overt methods, which can be, you know, this way, let's say you've got a teacher who speaks out about, you know, the principal's a bit racist, something like that. And so reprisals can be very simple, such as giving you a teaching roster or giving you the classes that you don't really want, or not approving leave, or not giving timely response requests, or not inviting people to meetings, and so they're missing out on things. That can be very effective. It's what I'd call petty harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's ostracism, the cold shoulder, which is when people sometimes, it's so bad, you know, you walk by in the hallway and the people don't even look at you. They're afraid to make eye contact. And that's, in many cases, it's other workers, colleagues, are afraid they'll be targeted as well. And so they cut off contact. And although it sounds like a trivial matter, well, what's it matter whether they say hello? But actually, personal contact in the workplace is one of the things that makes life possible for workers. It's
right.
Very hard to survive when no one's talking to you, and you're not getting the normal sort of social support and social contact. So that's very powerful. And then you've got the things like referral to psychiatrists. And here in Australia, there was a whole pattern. There was an agency called HealthQuest, and various employers, this might be an education department or the public service, they'd have some teacher they didn't want anymore, and they'd refer them to HealthQuest, and there were some tame psychiatrists who would always take the employer's line, and so they'd be certified as insane, and then they'd be dismissed. And there's a whole pattern of this.
Really?
Protests. Well, it goes on much more than we realize, but it's very hard to get organized because it don't often have an organization that's collecting these cases from a range of different organizations. And it's especially hard because within a school where a teacher is, has got offside with the principal, then there's rumors spread. It's another method of attack is spreading rumors, and it could be about, they're a poor worker, they're not conscientious, or they've got strange sexual habits. I mean, it can be all sorts of things. So those rumors are spread around, and then other teachers think, oh, that person actually is, they're the problem, they're the rotten apple.
We
and they're getting rid of them. Well, that's fine. They've just bought into the rumors. They've never checked them out. They've never talked to the person involved. So we've got all these sort of subtle methods, which are not easily treated by whistleblower laws. Whistleblower laws, they might work sometimes if it's a really blatant sort of case.
Right.
But if you got the rumor mongering, the ostracism, the petty harassment, it's often enough to drive people to actually become the thing that they're saying, because once you start suffering reprisals, it's very hard to maintain an even sort of natural presence in the workplace, and you start, your work starts suffering, your family life starts suffering, things go downhill, and then people say, well, look, yes, this person's not doing their job properly. We were right all along.
Yeah, yeah.
Self-fulfilling prophecy. And so it's, the big ones like, formal reprimands or investigations like into Wakefield and so forth, those are dramatic.
Right.
Dismissals are dramatic, and they can sometimes be challenged, but it's the subtle methods that actually get to most people.
Right, because it's that much harder to go against. If you take someone into a quasi-legal tribunal, there's always the possibility that the tribunal might not come out with the result that you want. I mean, probably the establishment has an 80% batting average, but there's still that 20% of times when it doesn't work out the way they want it.
Yes, one of the things that I often tell whistleblowers or advise them is before you go to one of the official channels, and here in Australia it might be the Ombudsman or the Auditor General,
right?
The Board of Management, Anti-Corruption Commission, there's all various possibilities. Before you go, check out the success rate of previous people who have gone along. And in the U.S., Tom Devine has done excellent work. He's in the Government Accountability Project. And I remember one of his articles, he said, oh, yes, the Congress passed this really good law and they wanted to protect whistleblowers, but then the courts were absolutely hopeless in actually supporting whistleblowers. And so you had like 49 out of 50 cases to go before a particular court went against the whistleblower. So if you knew that your chances were, 2% then you might say, well, maybe this is not such a good idea. Maybe I should go to the media instead, or set up a website. And what I do now is whenever possible, I recommend that people contact me before they've blown the whistle. I suggest consider leaking. Don't go public. Collect the evidence and provide it to a journalist or to one of the leaking websites like WikiLeaks, or set up your own anonymous site or feed it to an action group. It's sometimes the best thing. It depends a lot on the issue and the person.
Right.
But those, I think, are far better. And the other thing is if you leak anonymously, then, hey, it's a wonderful thing. They don't know you've done it. You're still in the workplace. You're still collecting information. You can keep feeding stuff and exposing it, and hopefully something will be done. And in the most amazing cases is, they're looking for the leaker, so they appoint the leaker. They don't know who it is. They appoint the leaker to the person to do the investigation.
That sounds like a good novel. a good spy novel. I know when the Edward Snowden leaks first started coming out, there were a lot of people who said, well, there's sort of this cowardice attack. I guess with Edward Snowden, he was public, but he left the country. And people would say, if you really believed in what you believed in, you would come back and stand up in court and say what you needed to say and take the consequences. And in other cases, when people have leaked anonymously, people say, well, you're a coward because you leaked anonymously and didn't put your name out there. But I think what you're saying is it's a lot more effective to do it anonymously. And if you're still in the system, you can continue to provide information.
Well, I think it's if you know you're up against a corrupt system and they're going to do you in, suicidal is the wrong word, but it's basically self-destructive to go ahead and speak out the way these people are recommending. And
they wouldn't
be saying to a soldier, oh, if you were brave, you just stand up, you know, in front of the guns.
Right.
It's just totally.
That's just plain stupid.
And Snowden is a model for others. I've written an article about this. He's a model in terms of whistleblower because he kept a low profile while he collected all the information. He learned all the technical side. I mean, he was a super expert at all the stuff. He was teaching people how to use these technologies. He did all this. He collected all the information, and then he did with great care. He went to journalists, and he didn't go to just any old journalist. If he'd gone to the New York Times, it never become a big story because the New York Times has a history of sitting on stories. They sat on the My Lai massacre back during the Vietnam War.
Right.
We had the Abu Ghraib scandal. You know, the U.S. mass media weren't going to touch it until it was going to be broken separately. So, you know, the regular U.S. mass media don't break these big stories. Snowden was wise enough to realize that, and so he organized to go to The Guardian, where you've got any particular journalist he wanted to be in touch with, Glenn Greenwald, and he spent months trying to convince Greenwald to take it up, and finally Snowden had to go through Laura Poitras to get to Greenwald. And so he knew the journalist he wanted, and The Guardian was ideal because they had a U.S. operation, so they could invoke freedom of speech there, but they're based in Britain, so they weren't tied to the sort of establishment the way the others were. So right, he did all that, but he also knew that he was going to be targeted, and so he initially wanted to go public immediately, but the journalist convinced him to be anonymous for a while longer. And then when he did go public, it was all the more effective because the initial stories had got the attention to the issue rather than to the whistleblower.
Right, I understand.
That's one of the hazards of being a whistleblower is the focus is on the whistleblower and not on the issue they're trying to, you know, they're speaking out about. And that's another reason why being a leaker is often more effective because we can't just talk about the whistleblower and reprisals and all that sort of stuff, which is, it's important, but it's in some ways it's a side issue from the actual problem.
Right. I think one of the more amusing things I saw in that was that he leaked information about how the NSA was spying on the Hong Kong government. And the Hong Kong government basically gave the Americans the middle finger salute when they tried to get him. They came up with some excuse about why they couldn't hand Snowden over without more paperwork. But by the time they got the paperwork, Snowden was already in Russia. I'm sure it was deliberate on the part of the Hong Kong government, because I'm sure that if they had really wanted to hand him over to the U.S., they could have easily found some excuse to do it.
That's right, and there's probably still things we don't know. There's, you know, things that were happening behind the scenes there, but Snowden is the model for a number of reasons, but I think one of them another reason he was very effective is he was so calm and cool in the way he presented himself. Now, very few people can do that when it's, you know, your life is at stake. I mean, he could have ended up, you know, in prison for life, and who knows what may happen in the future, but he knew his whole career was going down the plug hole, and yet he was sitting there and, you know, just totally focused on the message he had to get across, and that's very hard to do. There's one of the national security whistleblowers in Australia did this very well, and so he just stayed on message. You know, went to the media just before the Iraq War, and stayed on message and didn't get distracted into all sorts of other issues.
Yeah, well, it does become very personal sometimes. They like to pick on people's personal habits or their sexual habits or people that they once had a conversation with or things like that to divert the discussion away from illegal activities that might have been exposed by the whistleblower.
Yes.
Anyway, we've reached the end of the time that we have for this conversation. So I would just like to thank you for a very interesting and wide-ranging conversation on a lot of topics that really are related when you think about them. I guess we talked more about whistleblowers and scientific controversies than nonviolence, but there seems to be a thread that goes through all of them.
That's right. It's a pleasure talking with you, David. Okay. Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 62 of The Infectious Myth. If you've got a comment, a question, or a suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com, or like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth, or do all of these things. And until next week, goodbye.